Be that as it may. But I certainly would like to thank everyone who has worked to make this conference possible. I know a lot of people have put a lot of energy into this, and I certainly like to thank you for that, my wife, and certainly would like to join me in that, and hope that we can make a positive contribution for you. Like Dr. Vacciocci, I went to a different university. I went to a Methodist university. It was much more ecumenical than the Pontifical Gregorian University. In fact, one semester I had a Southern Baptist as a professor, a Presbyterian, a Methodist, an Episcopalian priest, and at least one other who probably had no religious persuasion at all. So, fortunately, on my diploma, they didn't put anything about accepting the Methodist faith because they weren't quite sure what they taught. But they did have some good jokes. And obviously, if I'm going to keep things rolling now after what you've just heard, we have a very good friend who is a restaurateur in Tyler, who is Italian. We simply know him as Giuseppe. I found out his surname this morning, Vacciocci. They obviously are relatives. And just sitting here listening to Dr. Vacciocci speaking, it was just as though Giuseppe was up here talking and carrying on and expressing himself about life. Anyway, so, you know, things rub off. Certainly, one of the priceless jokes I heard, the various faculty members of various religious persuasions would try and strike sparks off one another. And one told the class of a person arriving at the pearly gates, met by St. Peter, and welcomed in. And he said, look, I'm going to give you a guided tour, he said, because things are not quite the way you thought they would be up here. Things are somewhat different than what people on earth think they should be up here. And as they entered through the pearly gates into the heavenly realm, they came upon a bar, a pub, tavern, whatever you wish to call it, with people drinking to excess, much noise, much music, etc. And so the new arrival looked somewhat aghast, and he said, what's this? And he said, these are the Methodists. People get to do in heaven what they weren't allowed to do on earth. And so the Methodists are allowed to drink in heaven. And they wandered a little further into this wonderful theme park, and another loud noise came out of a place which was a dance hall. And here were people gyrating and moving and so forth eternally. And he said, who are these? And he said, now, the Baptists, they weren't allowed to dance. And they carried on through this until they came to a park with an elderly couple sitting on a bench. And he said, well, what religion were these people? He said, they were the Episcopalians. They were allowed to do everything in the past life. So, you know, I hate the point where we would be, or where Dr. Vacciocci would be in that scenario. The title of the address I have for this morning is that of the Sabbath and sectarian Judaism, which sounds rather highfalutin. We'll try and make it non-highfalutin. You might ask yourself, what is the purpose of examining sectarian Judaism? What is the purpose of examining first century Judaism in a conference which is given to the subject of the Sabbath? As I hope to show, much value can be accomplished if we strip away some of the hermeneutical or the interpretational misconceptions that have clouded studies of the New Testament and the Bible as a whole for the last half millennium. The majority of you attending today are involved, you might say, in the frontline struggle together with people and individuals against the problems faced by humanity on a daily basis, seeking answers to the problems of the day and other issues of this age. Detailed reconsideration of the foundational principles that go into our beliefs and not the daily interest of those engaged in the ministry or the laity. You might take the example that has existed over a period of time. Mankind used to believe in a flat earth. How many people spent time on a daily basis thinking, why do we believe in a flat earth as opposed to a globe or a sphere? The foundational concepts that we accept can very easily create difficulties for us. You can imagine the concept of people accepting the concept of a flat earth and the difficulties it created when somebody postulated, no, the earth is not flat, it is round. And the idea of sailing to the edge of the earth does not mean you fall off into nothing. The concept of something different comes as a great difficulty to people. The foundational concepts that underlie the interpretation of the New Testament and the Bible create constant difficulties for us. To give you an example, examine any commentary on the Epistle to the Galatians, and you will find very quickly conclusions based on wrong foundational assumptions. So why is first century Judaism of importance to Christians about to enter the 21st century? Well, for the last five centuries, theologians or Protestant theologians, biblical scholars, ministry, and laity have operated from a false premise that has affected to this day views on issues that are germane to the first century and to those of us gathered here today. Almost 500 years ago, an Augustinian monk named Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of a Wittenberg cathedral, igniting a fuse that was to change the world. Martin Luther reasoned from a particular viewpoint or worldview, or, if you want another worldwide Church of God speak, paradigm, that formed conclusions he came to, one of which has lasted to this day. We should remember that while Luther, a biblical scholar of some stature, was still a product of his age, his studies have been principally of the Bible in Latin. Erasmus, a contemporary of Luther's, had produced the first critical edition of the New Testament in Greek and had reintroduced or been instrumental in reintroducing the study of Greek into the church. The time was that of a renaissance, the rebirth of learning as well as the arts. Luther learned the Hebrew language, as did so many other church fathers, from a shadowy group of people, marginalized people, you might say, known as rabbis. Study of the Bible during medieval times leading up to Luther, while described as scholasticism, was principally a matter of allegorization, or looking for the hidden meaning behind what the text was saying, and trying to elicit hidden meanings out of a text, without any real concern for the historicity of the Bible. Scholars basically accepted whatever the church stated regarding historical matters. Luther clearly saw allegorization as being an invalid means of interpreting the Bible and required that the Bible be read and studied for its literal sense. And let me add as a writer that when one uses the term literal sense in terms of interpretation of the Bible, one obviously allows for such things as metaphors and figures of speech. So in talking about a literal interpretation of the Bible, one does not go around believing that you are a sheep because Christ is your shepherd, or that you are grapes on a vine. Those are automatically taken into account. It is easier to identify a former wrong than to rid yourself of the same. So it was with Luther. While rejecting allegories and allegorization, he ended up producing one of the most enduring allegories in his reading of Paul and Judaism and relating that to his own battle with Rome. Luther saw himself in a deadly conflict with a monolithic church, which because of various reasons, including the rejection of the authority of the Bible for the authority of man, had become petrified and unable to change. Hence, it had to be replaced. Luther read this scenario back into the Bible in the case of Paul and Judaism, Luther saw Paul fighting against a common foe, a petrified monolithic religion. In Paul's case, Judaism. Paul and Luther were fellow soldiers involved in a struggle against similar foes. Paul's battle was most clearly seen in his epistle to the Galatians, the book that Luther perceived as being central to Paul's theology. Paul's foe had the works of the law. Luther's had works, specifically indulgences. Luther's concerns about faith alone are well known to each of us. Justification by faith alone without the works of the law became the center of Pauline theology in Luther's mind, with Paul's statements on these subjects in Romans and Galatians being interpreted as a polemic or an argument against the law, which Luther saw as associated with a degenerate, organized religion. These approaches continue until this day in the minds of many. The misconceptions of Luther can clearly be seen as the basis for the current studies in theology, such as that written by Robert Brinsmead, an individual who needs no introduction to those of us gathered here. In his introductory chapter about the law and the Sabbath, Robert Brinsmead admits that he found Paul through Martin Luther. A few years ago, he states, God's gracious providence opened to me a door into the theology of Luther, and from Luther to Paul. I came to see that St. Paul's doctrine of justification by faith alone must call all teaching and all tradition into serious and radical question. Brinsmead is not alone in the matter, as can be evidenced by Stephen Westerholm's new book entitled Israel's Law and the Church's Faith, Paul and His Recent Interpreters, in which he argues for a retention of the Lutheran Paul. We'll look at other views on the center of Paul's theology later in this paper. Luther, unaware of the reality of the history of the early church, with minimal knowledge of the Jewish people and their relationships to the beginning of Christianity, assumed that Judaism was a singular religion, as was the Catholic Church. At best, division within Judaism could be equated with the division of the Catholic Church between the Dominicans and Augustinians, orders of the church with different emphases. Can such a comparison be made? From your own study of the Bible, you're aware of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The differences in some of the core beliefs are stated, especially that relating to the resurrection. While such a contrast is available today between liberal and conservative theologians, no such difference was known to have existed within the Catholic Church of Luther's day. Right from the pages of the New Testament, you have a very clear differentiation in the Judaisms that existed at that time. Josephus informs us of other divergences in beliefs between these two groups, and of divisions amongst the Pharisees. He also introduces us to another group, which is not specifically addressed in the New Testament, the Essenes, a group which he describes as being ascetics. We can add to this growing list the despised Samaritans, who, although Gentile in origin, clearly had a religion with certain commonalities to Judaism. Today, we can also be aware of the works of Philo, the Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, in the first century of the current era. He was neither Sadducee, Pharisee, Essene, or Samaritan, but represented yet another strand of Judaism, perhaps best described for the purposes of this occasion as Hellenized Judaism. So quickly, we have accounted for some five different varieties of Judaism. You might say it gives light to the idea if you get two Jews, you've got three opinions. The emerging church was simply seen as yet another form of Judaism. To Ananias, the high priest, Paul was considered an agitator among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, of course, in those days, the term sect did not have the pejorative flavor that it has today. But it was certainly seen as a sect of the Jews. Allowing for the nature of the charge against Paul, the church of which he was part, was clearly seen as being part of the Jewish religious scene. In earlier confrontations with the Sanhedrin or the council in Jerusalem, the church leaders and Jesus himself have been likened by Gamaliel to other Jewish religious visionaries who had raised up followings after themselves and had led people to destruction or confusion. What we find within first century Judaism was a clear plurality of religious views, often at variance with one another. Subsequent knowledge reveals even further cleavages in the understanding of these groups. A clear distinguishing factor that we've already touched upon was that of what constituted the canon of Scripture. The Sadducees and the Samaritans accepted the Torah alone as divine inspiration and the source for doctrine, although neither accepted the same Torah. The Pharisees accepted what we today consider the Old Testament, incorporating the threefold element of the law, prophets, and writings. The emergent church clearly followed the Pharisaic tradition as to what was Scripture. What the Essenes considered Scripture is currently open to debate. It could safely be said that their concept of Scripture was more in accord with the Pharisees than other groups, but with differences that we'll explore later. For Philo, the development of a Greek translation of the Holy Scriptures, known as the Septuagint, also shows a wider acceptance of a concept of Scripture than that shown by the Sadducees. At this point, we've not considered the application of apocryphal or pseudepigraphical literature produced during the period of the Second Temple. Clearly rejected by the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the church, this literature did influence the religious practices of certain groups within Judaism. Most relate this literature, especially much of the pseudepigraphical literature, to the Essenes, who were thought to have settled at Qumran. Although this theory is being challenged today, especially with certain identical works being found at Masada, a Zealot holdout, and at Qumran, two distinctly different communities. What we clearly have is a plurality of religious ideas based upon acceptance of part or all of a set of scriptures considered to be holy. One recent author examining the state of first century Judaism expressed the situation as, quote, a fundamental characteristic of Judaism is its fragmentary nature, a plurality of group movements and traditions of thoughts that have coexisted in a complex dialectic relationship. Jacob Neusner, one of the most prolific writers of the intertestamental Judaism at this particular time, Neusner's definition of Judaism would fit Christianity as well. Where he says, when a religious system appeals as an important part of its authoritative literature or canon to the Hebrew scriptures of ancient Israel or Old Testament, we have a Judaism. We have a situation of multiple Judaisms, which includes Christianity. If diversity existed in terms of what constituted Scripture, diversity existed in terms of other facets of Hebrew life or Jewish life. Most will be aware of the differences that existed in the calendrical calculations of the festival of Pentecost between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees counting the day from the weekly Sabbath during the festival of unleavened bread, the latter from the first day of unleavened bread itself. Thus, in the majority of years, the Feast of Pentecost would have been held on different days by the two groups. The calendrical problems and feast days are compounded further on appreciation that Jewish views on the calendar were almost as divergent as they were on the canon of Scripture. The Hebrew calendar, as we know it today, is passed down to us from the first century, is a lunar solar calendar, based on the lunations of the moon, but corrected through the addition of intercalary days and months to maintain the seasons in conjunction with the movement of the earth in relation to the sun in a metonic cycle. However, the Book of Jubilees introduces another calendar used by sections of the Jews, which was strictly solar, a 364-day calendar. The Book of Jubilees is what we would classify as pseudepigraphical rather than canonical. It is understood to have been written sometime in the second century before Christ and is considered to reflect a Hasidic proto-Essene viewpoint. The book claims to be a revelation of the second Torah given to Moses on Mount Sinai by an angel of the presence. The calendar outlined in Jubilees is considered the only correct calendar for calculating sacred days, months, and especially the Jubilee years. Moses is instructed by the angel to tell the people to count and so forth, the 364-day year, and if they don't do that, then they will corrupt the feast, and so forth. You can read that, Jubilee 6, verses 32 to 37. The purpose for the strict observance of the calendar and days was because they were believed to coincide with the gathering of the angelic realm to worship before God's throne in heaven. Failure to follow this calendar meant that worship would then be out of harmony with worship in the spirit world, and the worshipers would be denied the benefits of communion with the heavenly realm, with the consequent benefits of holiness and blessings received by the angelic host. And so he talks about how the Feast of Pentecost, it was celebrated in heaven from the day of creation until the day of Noah. Likewise, the weekly Sabbath is kept in heaven. On this day, we keep the Sabbath in heaven before it was made known to any human to keep the Sabbath thereon upon the earth. The purpose was to keep the Sabbath with the angels of the presence and of the sanctification, that we might keep the Sabbath with him in heaven and on earth. The angel promised that the person who kept the Sabbath will be holy and blessed always like us. The desired result from the conduct was universal harmony and fellowship. And when I use the term universal, I mean universal in the largest extent. The Book of Jubilees was not alone in this view of the Sabbath and the festivals. First Enoch and a recently discovered work entitled The Angelic Liturgy support similar views. The era of following a lunar calendar was considered a matter of corruption by the writer of First Enoch. A book written to highlight the role of angels as revealers of the law, which emphasizes the place of a solar calendar instead of a Pharisaic, Sadducean, lunar solar calendar. The result of following the correct calendar brings about righteousness and the privilege of having angelic revelations from God. Enoch is told that the calendar was corrupted before the flood by fallen angels, which led to people observing festivals at incorrect times, while righteous angels would correct this by revealing to Enoch the true sacred calendar. Copies of the angelic liturgy were found as a result of recent archaeological discoveries in Israel at both Masada and Qumran, and the text was published in full in 1985. The nature of this text places it in a similar religious context to that of Jubilees and First Enoch, wherein angels are heavenly priests who observe the sacred calendar. The document includes 13 songs that were to be offered to God during the weekly Sabbath sacrifice. Following a call of the audience to worship, the song describes the angelic praise around God's throne that the people are to participate in. Of even more recent publication is a document found at Qumran titled MMT, an acronym for the Hebrew title of Mitzvot Ma'as HaTorah, or in English, Works of the Law. Once again, the document begins with a recitation of a 364-day calendar. These books reveal attitudes towards the Sabbath and festivals that are not clearly part of the Pharisaic tradition revealed in the New Testament. The closest that the New Testament comes to using the type of imagery we have examined above is in the book of Hebrews, where the writer contrasts the gathering of Israel at Sinai with that of a church. Where in chapter 12 he said, "You have not come to Mount Sinai, but you have come rather to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all." Here the focus is upon the firstborn and God, not necessarily the angelic gathering. They are secondary to the argument being presented. What we can establish is a diversity in first century Judaism not only in terms of a canon, but in terms of a calendar and the consequential results in worship of following those calendars. If the books we have touched upon were related to the Essenes, it may provide some insight into Josephus' statement about the Essenes not frequenting the temple as festivals were held on different days, and the Sabbath clearly had other goals than those sought by the Pharisees or the Sadducees. The degree of differences and the resulting complications in society can perhaps be appreciated by many of the audience today who keep annual Sabbaths outlined in Leviticus 23 based on the Hebrew lunar solar calendar in a society that is geared to keeping days based on a Gregorian calendar. Throughout this, we have not examined differences amongst people's religious views based on apocalyptic or eschatological concepts that were extant in that society. Clearly, what we have established is great diversity in that first century Jewish society. We could inquire then more deeply into Luther's assertion of Judaism being a religion that required justification through the works of the law and find his concepts also equally lacking. Scholarship of this century undertaken by Moore, Schweitzer, Davies, who all wrote prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 47, lead to the conclusion, as stated by Davies, that Paul remained true to Jewish tradition and observance. He had a positive relationship with the traditions of the Jewish apostles, and the doctrine of justification was not central to his thought, nor was it directed against Judaism as such. Subsequently, this position has been affirmed in the work of Stendhal, Sanders, and others who have been able to draw upon knowledge available from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The results of these studies are perhaps best exemplified by a new commentary on Galatians, written by John Ziesler. In his work, he raises the question regarding justification. And he states, Paul does not say that it's impossible to keep the law, but rather that this is not the way to find justification. Did anyone think it was? Ziesler continues to make a well-established point that mainstream Judaism, i.e. the Pharisees, Sadducees, did not see itself as a religion based upon a works righteousness, but rather the keeping of the law, was, as he states, the people's grateful response, their way of living within the covenant which he had generously given them. Law observance is not what constitutes Israel as God's people. Though, of course, Judaism did and does teach that such observance is the way of living as his people. And, of course, you can read the latter half of Deuteronomy chapter 10, where that concept is very clearly set up. Ziesler continues to postulate who Paul may have been addressing in Galatians and suggests that Paul was confronting a form of sectarian Judaism who believed in merit-centered form of justification. He concludes his idea by saying, while the possibility can't be ruled out, there is no contemporary evidence for it. Like everyone who publishes, he published a year too soon. Or, on the other hand, he now has a reason for a new edition. The most recent publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that I mentioned of MMT, to which we have referred earlier. This provides, in the view of one author, the, quote, smoking gun, close quote, which students have been searching for generations, not from the pages of rabbinic literature, but from the sectarian teachings of Qumran. MMT demonstrates that Paul was not jousting with windmills, but was indeed squared off in a dramatic duel, not with mainstream Judaism, but with a sectarian theology. His conclusion is that the importance of this document for, quote, New Testament research is nothing short of revolutionary. Clearly, it should help put Martin Luther's concepts about Judaism and the emerging church to rest, and provide a basis for a re-examination of all aspects of the New Testament and the relationship of the church to the law, especially the Sabbath day. A re-evaluation is clearly called for of a series of oppositions that have dominated Protestant theology as a result of Luther's hermeneutic. Love versus law. Grace versus law. Faith versus works. Lest Luther depart this day as a person who had it all wrong, let me hasten to his defense. His misconceptions were not his own, nor is he solely responsible for the confusion he had caused. The Jews he had dealt with in the 16th century were the heirs of rabbinic Judaism, that form of Judaism that won the day after the fall of a temple in 70 CE. The rabbis did their best in the 1st and 2nd century to advance the idea that they were the only true form of Judaism. Record and detail of the smaller sectarian groups had disappeared with them following the fall of a nation to the Roman legions between 66 and 73 CE. And so we can see a hermeneutical principle that has existed within Christian theology for the last 500 years since Luther needs to be seriously re-examined. For those of you who want to study further in this, the two sources I would give you. Firstly, a short article in a magazine known as the Theological Educator that you can probably find in most libraries. It's an article by Gerald L. Stevens, and it's entitled Paul and the Law in Galatians. Very readable, obviously written without great pretension, and able to be understood by literally any church member. It's an ideal starting point which introduces you to the current debate and the relevant scholars who are involved in that debate. A more detailed exposition of the historical scene is laid out in the first chapter of a book I've got here, a rather black book, entitled Paul and the Jewish Law, Halakhah and the Letters of the Apostle to the Gentiles. And once again, we get back to Latin again, because this book is published by a organization that has a Latin name. Compendia Rerum Judaicarum ad Novum Testamentum. That's about all the Latin I know. It is published by a group of people, a group of scholars, of both Christian and Jewish persuasions. Basically, European theologians and Hebrew University. And they have produced a number of books over the last 10 years re-examining the details of first century Judaism and the emerging church. And they provide some very interesting study in terms of the material that we are concerned about. And so we find that history proves that the concepts Martin Luther had were wrong. The decisions he came to, the understandings he came to based upon those decisions were incorrect. And society, you might say, has been saddled with the consequences of those to this very day. I'm delighted to hear from Dr. Bacciocci the detail of discussion that is prepared to exist within other organizations in relation to the Sabbath day. And I'm sure it will be a very profitable discussion that we collectively, individually, can be involved in.